Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Historic decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court on LGBTQ civil rights and DACA. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer after the Supreme Court blocked the Trump administration from ending the program for undocumented youth.
Let me say to all of our great DACA kids and their families, this is just the beginning. You are going to become American citizens and great American citizens.
Former National Security Advisor John Bolton unleashes on President Trump in his long-awaited new book.
I don't think he's fit for office. I don't think he has the competence to carry out the job. There really isn't any guiding principle that I was able to discern other than what's good for Donald Trump's reelection.
And today, as we celebrate Juneteenth, a continued national reckoning on racism and police violence. President Trump signed an executive order this week.
We will have reform without undermining our many great and extremely talented law enforcement officers.
It's our Week in the News roundtable, and we have a great panel to break it all down for us today. From Washington, Lisa Desjardins of the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, great to have you with us.
Oh, so good to be here.
And from New York, Hayes Brown, world editor at BuzzFeed. He's co-host of the BuzzFeed podcast News O'Clock. Hayes, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And Eugene Scott, political reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us from Fire Island, New York. Eugene, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with the Supreme Court delivering a big defeat to President Trump yesterday. In a major decision, the Supreme Court stopped President Trump's move to end DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program started under President Obama. DACA protects hundreds of thousands of immigrants brought to the U.S. as children from deportation. Lisa Desjardins, first to you here, the significance of this decision.
Well, it's very significant, at least for the time being, for hundreds of thousands, upwards of 700,000 people in this country who've been in limbo and worried that the Trump administration might be able to move to deport them. But there is an even larger implication here, which is on Capitol Hill, both Republicans and Democrats are recognizing that this decision is narrow and that it is really, in a way, only for the time being. It doesn't have to do with the substance of what the president did so much as the way that he did it. The court is saying that he did not give enough of a reasonable rationale for rolling back DACA. So that really is putting the pressure on Congress, and both sides realize it. That for this group, there needs to be a legislative solution ultimately. And there is talk now of renewing a reform effort. I don't know. It's day two. We'll see how that goes. But I think it has implications about this issue, again, having an opening for lawmakers to actually address it head on.
Well, it was a 5-4 ruling. The majority opinion was written by the Republican-appointed Chief Justice John Roberts, who said the Trump administration's decision to rescind DACA was, quote, arbitrary and capricious, and it failed to consider the hardship to DACA recipients. Three of the dissenting conservative justices said the decision was an effort to, quote, avoid a politically controversial but legally correct decision. Eugene Scott, this was a surprising setback to one of President Trump's central campaign promises. How did you see it?
Well, we have to remember that one of the president's central campaign promises was to take a hard line on immigration because he viewed illegal immigration as a public safety issue. But he was going up against a narrative about DACA recipients that existed long before he entered presidential politics. These are individuals who are largely in school or working or pursuing many of the values that people consider to be part of the American dream and not public safety threats, which is in part why there's so much support, even from some on the right, for DACA recipients. The president was put in a hard place in terms of trying to prove that what he was arguing was correct.
Well, the president lashed out on Twitter saying, quote, these horrible and politically charged decisions coming out of the Supreme Court are shotgun blasts into the face of people that are proud to call themselves Republicans or conservatives. Hayes Brown, what did you make of this decision and the Chief Justice John Roberts here as the swing vote?
I think that that makes total sense based on everything we've seen from Roberts during his time as Chief Justice. We saw it on the Obamacare issue. We saw it on the first attempt for the president to issue his Muslim travel ban. Roberts doesn't want to make these big sweeping decisions that will have a lot of impact on other cases outside of the ones he's ruling on, it seems like. He's been issuing these narrow rulings that are very correct, but they're all procedural. And I think that's what's got the president and his allies so infuriated. But it's also probably one of the most canny things that the Chief Justice could do, because at this point, it's extremely clear that the Trump administration is almost allergic to doing things in the proper way, in the way that is prescribed by law in a lot of cases, that you have to go through certain steps and procedures in order to make laws and regulations. So Roberts knows that, and Roberts knows that he can make these rulings and continue to push back on the Trump administration without setting too many precedents down that would hamstring future presidents down the line.
As we said, hundreds of thousands of immigrants brought to the U.S. as children impacted by this decision. Here's Eva Martinez-Garcia. She's a DACA recipient in the Bay Area, where she spoke to a local CBS affiliate after the Supreme Court's decision yesterday. She came to the U.S. with her parents when she was 7 years old.
DACA is great. It's allowing us to work. It's allowing us to have some of the basic rights that, you know, U.S. citizens have. But it's very obvious that there's still a lot more to be done for the immigrant population and for DACA recipients.
Lisa Desjardins, as you said, this was a narrow decision for DACA recipients. It was momentous. But you talked about the pressure on Congress now. What are the legislative efforts moving forward as you see them?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. One is this certainly does increase the pressure, and that we are hearing from more Republicans again, including the most conservative Republicans, who say that really Congress has to fix this. However, that pressure has been there for a long time. The United States policy is out of step with where the American public is. The public overwhelmingly supports a status, a permanent status for this group of people. But Congress has not been able to navigate its own politics. So it is an increased opening, I think. It shines a light on the pressure that has been on Congress. I do think one factor that could help move toward compromise, a narrow compromise just on DACA, is that we're seeing Republicans in the Senate more nervous about being able to keep the Senate. And this is one of those issues that some of those vulnerable Republicans, if they were able to reach a compromise, it would probably help them in the fall.
Well, the DACA ruling comes on the heels of another huge ruling, Monday's victory for gay and transgender Americans. The Supreme Court ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 makes it illegal for employers to discriminate because of a person's sex. Well, that applies also to sexual orientation and to transgender status. Eugene Scott, your reaction to this major decision on Monday.
You know, this was a huge decision, and one that many people in the LGBT community force about because of the court's conservative bent, and certainly didn't see Neil Gorsuch making the decision that he did. But individuals I spoke with who are work in the activist space and gay rights organizations say that this is just one step that is a part of a long journey that really needs next to focus on the Equality Act in Congress, which would be federal legislation passed by Congress that would actually protect Americans from being discriminated based on their sexual orientation.
Here's President Trump reacting to the Supreme Court's decision on LGBTQ civil rights. This was on Monday.
I've read the decision, and some people were surprised, but they've ruled, and we live with their decision. That's what it's all about. We live with the decision of the Supreme Court. Very powerful, a very powerful decision, actually.
Hayes Brown, the Trump administration had argued against Monday's outcome in this civil rights case. And I've been reading all week that gay and transgender rights groups consider this case a highly significant one, perhaps even more important than the fight to get the right to marry, because nearly every LGBTQ adult has a job or needs one, right? How did you see this, Hayes Brown?
I completely agree. I think that what's really amazing about this decision was the fact that it did completely firmly agree with the fact that any firing of a person because of their sexuality or gender identity would not have been the same decision if that person had been of another sex. Therefore, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act absolutely does apply. That's a really sweeping decision, and one that, and a precedent that I think will have reverberations in other cases that come before the court moving down the line. If say, for example, a person is discriminated against because and can prove that it's because of their gender, then or because of their sexual orientation or their gender identity, then now they can point back at this case and say that the Supreme Court has ruled that that is discriminatory and can move forward from that point. Mm.
So, Lisa Desjardins, two really big defeats for the president this week. The president writing on Twitter, quote, "Do you get the impression that the Supreme Court doesn't like me?" I guess there's good reason to think that the majority of the justices don't trust the rationale being offered in this moment by the administration on these major initiatives, right? How do you see it?
Well, it's interesting that I think this week shows us a lot about this court. And while it's seen as dominated by conservatives, it is a majority of the justices appointed by conservative presidents. We're seeing some real important differences. For example, that LGBT case, that was written by Justice Gorsuch. And I think if you pay attention to where he is on the political spectrum, he's really a libertarian. You know, he doesn't always agree with the most conservative wing of the justices on the court. And then you see Justice Roberts, who wrote the DACA decision. He is someone exactly, as Hayes was saying, who likes to tailor decisions very narrowly. But when he does that, he does seem to lean against kind of the conservative push. Now, that's raising problems for him politically, as we hear Republicans calling him out. But I think the point is that when you think about this court, really, there are two members that are very conservative, Justices Alito and Thomas. And then the rest of the Republican bench is someone that you have to consider case by case.
Lisa Desjardins, PBS NewsHour, Hayes Brown from BuzzFeed, and Eugene Scott from The Washington Post. Stick with me. We're talking about the week in the news. And up next, we'll get to John Bolton's highly anticipated new book, and police reform. I'm Jane Clayson. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit. Period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the week in the news, and I'm here with a great panel guiding us through it all. Hayes Brown from BuzzFeed, Lisa Desjardins from the PBS NewsHour, and Eugene Scott from The Washington Post. Well, a bombshell new book out this week. John Bolton, President Trump's former national security advisor, conservative, of course, former Fox News contributor, really laying it on here about his time in the White House. In this book, he claims President Trump was repeatedly played by world leaders and, in his words, quote, is unfit for office. Hayes Brown, I'll start with you on this one. Books by other former Trump officials have been more nuanced, but boy, this one is unrelenting. Your reaction?
My reaction is that, of course, John Bolton was going to write this book. He came out swinging after leaving the Bush administration. So, course, after leaving an administration as chaotic as the Trump administration, he would have some thoughts. The marriage between John Bolton and Donald Trump was always one of convenience. Trump liked Bolton because he went on TV and said nice things about the president. Bolton wanted to continue to push the president on his favorite topic, Iran. And it's really interesting that for all of the many bombshells inside of Bolton's book, one that all of them basically just confirmed things we already knew about the president, that he is easily susceptible to flattery, that he can only think about things in terms of himself and his reelection. But it also was interesting to see the fact that Bolton, he was the fact that of all the things that he saw in the White House, the thing that he thought was the most maddening and most crazy was the fact that the president canceled a series of strikes on Iran. So that just shows where Bolton's priorities were this entire time.
Well, here he is, John Bolton, on ABC News, an interview ahead of his book release slated for next week, Tuesday, actually. Here is how he described President Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin.
I think Putin thinks he can play him like a fiddle. I think Putin is smart, tough. I think he sees that he's not faced with a serious adversary here. I don't think he's worried about Donald Trump.
Lisa Desjardins, among other things, Bolton describes instances when the president sought to halt criminal inquiries, mm-hmm. that he used trade negotiations and criminal investigations to further his political interests, and that the Senate impeachment inquiry should have investigated the president for more than just pressuring Ukraine. And a lot of people are asking, well, John Bolton, why'd you wait until now to say all this rather than testify during the impeachment trial, which you covered, Lisa? What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe the impeachment trial was actually not all that long ago. It feels like years.
Right.
But I think that this is a very, and when you get into the process about this, then it gets very tricky, because Bolton says he was willing to testify, did not because he wasn't subpoenaed. And indeed, Democrats did not subpoena him. They did request him to speak to them. So you can kind of go a little bit down a rabbit hole of who's to blame, but clearly both sides contributed to the fact that John Bolton did not testify before Congress. Now, the U.S. Senate voted on whether to have witnesses or not. Only one Republican, Mitt Romney, really wanted those witnesses and pushed hard for it. But he is saying, again, he wished that he had had them. So I guess the bigger question is, where are we? And now it almost seems like we're waiting to see if the House Democrats do more with this. Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee who led the impeachment investigation, said he is now huddling with Nancy Pelosi to see what their next steps will be on this. But these allegations are very serious, and they could be just as serious or more serious than what the impeachment was about, depending on what we learn from Bolton's book and what can be verified. Mm.
Here's White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany speaking to reporters on Wednesday about John Bolton.
Former National Security Advisor John Bolton should know all too well that it's unacceptable to have highly classified information from the government of the United States in a book that will be published. It's unacceptable.
So, Eugene Scott, the Trump administration is suing to try to keep this book from being released. And today a federal judge will hear those last-ditch arguments to that end. But hundreds of thousands of books have already gone out. Democrats on Capitol Hill are talking about having Bolton testify, to Lisa's point. What do you see happening next in Washington on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, I imagine that Bolton's team will continue to push back on the accusation that there's highly classified information in the book. His team said that there is not. But the criticisms of Trump and his administration, and quite frankly, of Bolton also, have already been made public, have already been the concern of lawmakers on the left and maybe some on the right. And so it seems that people in Congress are already having conversations about what the next move should be heading forward to what they believe protect the country from a president who seems to be governing focused more on his personal interests than the national security of Americans.
Well, we'll keep watching. For the moment, let's turn to Atlanta, where some police officers there have called in sick, apparently to protest criminal charges against two officers in the shooting death of Rayshard Brooks in that Wendy's parking lot. Two officers involved surrendered themselves yesterday. They were booked. It was reported this week that the officer who fired the shots that killed Brooks shouted, "I got him." He kicked Brooks as he was on the ground dying. Hayes Brown, another week defined by this national conversation about race and policing.
Yeah, so I think that it's really important how quickly the Fulton County District Attorney Paul Howard moved to actually lay down charges against these two officers. The first one who you mentioned kicking Mr. Brooks when he was down, that was Garrett Rolfe. This has moved much faster than we normally see in police shootings. The officer Ralph was fired the next day. The fact that his partner, who was also charged with lesser crimes, has been apparently cooperating with the prosecution, and the fact that Ralph has been charged with felony murder, even though Paul, the district attorney, knows that he can't get a grand jury to sign the indictments before, say, January or February, it's really important that the ball on this has already gotten moving. Mm.
Rayshard Brooks' family members spoke at an emotional press conference in Atlanta this week. Here's his cousin, Tiara Brooks.
The trust that we have with the police force is broken. And the only way to heal some of these wounds is through a conviction and a drastic change with the police department.
Lisa Desjardins, the district attorney there, as we say, will not seek the death penalty in this case. That was a significant decision. Mm-hmm. Your reaction here and to another controversial police shooting in Los Angeles just last night.
That's right. There's yet another shooting that we're watching in Los Angeles. I guess let me start with Atlanta and then work back. But I think one thing I'm watching in the Atlanta case, and there's so much important here, is that the second police officer who's charged in this case, not the one who fired the guns, but who was there, actually is the first officer in any of these recent cases who I think has spoken publicly. He was on MSNBC yesterday in an interview with his attorney. He called what happened a tragedy. And it's interesting to me that officer is now trying to address what happened in a way that we haven't heard other officers do. And obviously there's a problem we see in some police forces where some officers are not showing up to work. In Buffalo, we saw sort of a mass protest when there was some kind of action taken against a couple officers there. So I think it's really important how officers handle this as well. I think we've got to watch all of these shootings all around the country. And what's terrible about it is that they just keep happening. And I think we need to keep every single day on top of them. You're right. So in Los Angeles, there was a security guard who was protecting a young security guard, protecting an auto body shop. Their police were called to that scene. That security guard, according to reports, may have pulled out his weapon. It's unclear, but he ran from the police, perhaps scared. We're not quite sure why. Police shot and killed him. And there's a lot more to learn about that. But that's another case of someone who was in uniform protecting a building and was shot and killed by police yesterday.
Well, this all comes as President Trump signed an executive order aimed at police reforms this week. Eugene Scott, tell us about that. What reforms is the president hoping for here?
Well, the president isn't focused on any of the reforms that individuals affiliated with the cause to defund the police are suggesting. He primarily wants to provide incentives for police departments to improve training and perhaps even keep some level of a national record for police misconduct. But he's given police large freedom and flexibility in terms of using some of the tools that many critics of law enforcement want to see eliminated, like chokeholds. And it's worth noting that even when you tell police that they can use chokeholds only in the event that their lives are at risk, that's actually what's already happening. And that is the defense we see many law enforcement officers using. And that has been of concern to those who really want to see police departments reformed beyond what the president is suggesting.
Here is President Trump speaking in the Rose Garden on Tuesday as he unveiled his executive order on policing.
Americans believe we must support the brave men and women in blue who police our streets and keep us safe. Americans also believe we must improve accountability, increase transparency, and invest more resources in police training, recruiting, and community engagement.
accountability, increased transparency, more resources. Interestingly, the vast majority of law enforcement decisions are made at the state and local levels. So this really only incentivizes local departments, Hayes Brown. I mean, the president himself seemed to acknowledge the restraints of any unilateral action this week, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And that's one area where the president and former President Obama actually agree. I was just thinking about how in his recent address to the My Brother's Keeper program, former President Obama noted exactly that, that a lot of these reforms will have to take place at the hyper-local level. And it's going to be interesting to watch how that plays out, both in terms of at the in state house elections in 2020, and as well as whether we'll see, you know, further ballot initiatives down the line for the upcoming election cycles, whether we'll see at the local level, we'll see these smaller protests in smaller cities continue to try and put pressure on mayors and city councils around the country. And you're seeing that it's having some effect. You, like, for example, the Minneapolis City Council voting to defund and disband their police department in the wake of George Floyd's death. So these sort of things can happen and changes can be made. The question is, will the those who are in disagreement with it continue to lean on the president and his disagreement with the need for major reforms to continue to resist?
Well, critics say the executive order, Eugene, says nothing about racial disparities in policing. That was absent.
It was. And one of the reasons that's of significant concern is because over the past few weeks, there have been at least two key aides from the Trump administration who have said that they do not believe that implicit bias or systemic racism are a part of our country's police culture, which, quite frankly, is the exact opposite of what most Americans believe, and certainly those protesting. And so the president not even speaking to address this issue sends a clear signal to those concerned about it that he does not see a problem and therefore has no plan to fix it.
Well, on Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans unveiled their police reform bill on Wednesday, called it the Justice Act. Here's Senator Tim Scott, a Republican from South Carolina and the lead sponsor of the bill.
Too often we're having a discussion in this nation about, are you supporting the law enforcement community or are you supporting communities of color? This is a false binary choice.
So, Lisa Desjardins, Democrats in the House have introduced their own policy reform proposal, which would ban chokeholds, as we discussed, create a national police misconduct registry, stop the use of no-knock arrest warrants. How do you see these two bodies sort of working this out here?
Yeah, you know, I think if you look at the past 3 weeks as just this momentous, important time when Americans rose up and took to the streets, look at next week as perhaps just as important in terms of what lawmakers on Capitol Hill do, that small group who lead our country, because the House plans to pass its policing bill next week, and it's very possible the Senate could move to its policing bill as well. But the problem is that Democrats and Republicans are very far apart. The Tim Scott bill, the Republican bill, is similar in a way to what the president's executive order does. It does discourage, essentially ban chokeholds. It also encourages police cameras. But otherwise, that bill generally takes the tact of, we need more information. So it asks for more data, more reporting. Those things take a long time. And, you know, Tim Scott admits that. It's not perfect. He knows not everyone, people want more, but he thinks this is what can be done now. He's working very hard to try and bring his conference along. But Democrats say that's falls very far short. They may not even allow that bill to be brought up. It needs Democratic support to open debate. And so Democrats have a difficult choice that they will have to make in the next couple of days. Do they even allow debate in the Senate on this bill or not?
Well, back in the House, Representative Cedric Richmond, a Democrat from Louisiana who is black, became frustrated with his Republican colleagues during a House Judicial Committee hearing on Wednesday when they added amendments to a police reform bill that were only tangentially related.
To my colleagues, especially the ones that keep introducing amendments that are a tangent and a distraction from what we're talking about, you all are white males. You never lived in my shoes and you do not know what it's like to be an African-American male. And all I'm saying is, if you are opposed to this legislation, let's just have the vote. But please do not come in this committee room and make a mockery of the pain that exists in my community.
Richmond went on to discuss his personal experiences with police and his concern for his son's safety. That prompted Representative Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican, to react angrily.
I appreciate your passion. Are you suggesting that you're certain that none of us have non-white children? Because you reflected on your black son and you said none of us could understand.
Matt, stop. I'm not about to get sidetracked about the color of our children. We're talking about black kids. I reclaim my time.
You said that
I reclaimed my time. I know.
You want the discussion?
I know
the
that
gentleman.
You want a bill?
Gentleman reclaimed his time.
Eugene Scott, some passionate expressions in Congress this week.
Absolutely, and I was able to speak with Congressman Richmond after that, and his frustration obviously was that Gaetz was sidetracked. Richmond was talking about the experiences of black Americans. And the reality is whether or not Gaetz has a son or not, and we found out this week that he did after this incident, he did not have a black son. And that was the issue that Richmond was trying to communicate about racism and police violence against black Americans, not about the legality of who's a dad and who's not. And it became a huge issue for Republicans and Democrats trying to find a solution to this problem.
Well, we're discussing another historic week in the news in the backdrop of all this, of police reform and racism. There's still the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll get to that after the break. More than a dozen states seeing surges in coronavirus cases. Lisa Desjardins, Hayes Brown, Eugene Scott, stick with me. We'll talk about that and more. Juneteenth also today. We'll get to that. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. More after this break. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Welcome back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. It's our weekly news roundtable this hour with a great panel to take us through it. Hayes Brown from BuzzFeed, Eugene Scott from The Washington Post, and Lisa Desjardins from the PBS NewsHour. Well, we learned this week that 1.5 million American workers filed for unemployment claims. That's 13 straight weeks with more than a million claims per week and more than 45 million Americans unemployed. That comes as more than a dozen states are seeing surges in coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. Lisa Desjardins, what's the latest on this on the pandemic right now nationwide?
Well, we just in the last 24 hours that were reported, the country saw 22,000 new cases. And if you look at the running 3-week average, sort of overall, we're exactly where we were 3 weeks ago in terms of new cases. So in a way, the good news is the curve is flat, but the curve is not going down, which was one of the requirements, essentially, of reopening. However, states feel ready to reopen. At the same time, some of the largest states reopening, California, Arizona, Texas, Florida, those four states are seeing record increases in cases. So it could be a dangerous time. We don't really know. One perhaps bright spot, we're learning more about the virus. It looks like from initial data, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that it doesn't look like all of the protests themselves led to increased coronavirus cases. Perhaps that's because of mask wearing. We don't know. But there still is so much we don't know. Also, there's still continued very large fatality rates, especially at nursing homes, which make up 25% of the deaths in this country. So it's not that we're not out of the woods. We don't even know where the exit is for the woods are yet. But the country and the economy is reopening. Obviously, that's also a crisis, but it seems to be a precarious time.
Well, a cheap drug called dexamethasone this week shown to improve survival rates of coronavirus patients. It's a steroid, widely available, reduced deaths by up to a third in the severely ill hospitalized patients it was tested on. Dr. Anthony Fauci said it was good news, that it improves therapeutic options that are out there right now. Hayes Brown, how are you viewing this moment in the pandemic with cases on the rise again, officials deciding whether to stay the course on reopening, what to do sort of moving forward? How do you see it, Hayes?
I mean, I see it as a terribly political right now. It's really unfortunate that this public health crisis has become sort of a political punching bag on whether you wear a mask or not. The president himself said the other day that people around him have said that the president views it as an attack on him and people only wearing masks to show the displeasure of the president. And that sort of thinking, that sort of narrative, is really dangerous moving forward, especially at this time. Many of the states were, that have had record increases, the overall number of cases isn't that high yet. Hospitals still aren't overwhelmed, but hospital systems are extremely worried about that, having seen what happened in New York, the New York area, at the start of this crisis. So they know that the resources still aren't there that they'd requested from the beginning. They know that if we move forward with reopening in the way that we have, sort of piecemeal and haphazard without requirements, people indoors need to wear masks to prevent the spread of this disease that sometimes you don't show symptoms until you've been contagious for days, then we could see spikes that not only increase the record growth in cases, but the overall number could hit way higher than we're ready to deal with. Mm.
Well, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, crowds are lining up today for President Trump's rally there tomorrow. Close to 100,000 people are expected to be on hand this weekend in Tulsa for the rally itself, for counter-protests. And this despite a spike in coronavirus cases in Oklahoma and fears that the event could be a COVID super spreader, especially in that arena, which holds 19,000 people. Eugene Scott, what should we expect this weekend in Tulsa?
Well, this will be the president's first return to a rally since the pandemic began, and he likely is going to be on the defense, considering that he's been criticized significantly these past 3 months about his response to the pandemic, his position on police violence against black people, and the revelations of this John Bolton book. And so he really will try his best, we imagine, to keep his base as close to him as possible by reminding them of what he has done since entering the White House. But there's one argument that he constantly makes that he will not be able to truthfully make this time, and that is that he has presided over an amazing economy. That no longer is the case, and it'll be interesting to see how voters respond to that.
Here's President Trump on Wednesday. A reporter for Gray TV asked him if he was concerned about this weekend's rally in Oklahoma, whether it could lead to more COVID infections in a state where cases are already on the rise. Here is President Trump's response.
The numbers are very minuscule compared to what it was. It's dying out. By the way, we're doing very well in vaccines and therapeutics also. I think there's going to be some big announcements on that in the not too distant future. But no, we're not concerned.
We're not concerned, Lisa Desjardins. Every attendee to this rally will get a temperature check, hand sanitizer, and a mask, though masks are not required. Tulsa's top health official says he wishes the rally would be postponed to a later date. Mm-hmm. A group even sued unsuccessfully to try to get this event moved outdoors. Your thoughts on all this?
Well, it is a real test. I got to echo exactly such great points by Eugene and Hayes about what the president's doing here and the politics. We'll watch. I mean, we'll see how many more rallies he plans and going ahead. Obviously, the president's base loves these rallies. They want to get out there. And we're really just seeing two Americas in terms of how not just politics, but how this virus is viewed.
Eugene, how is this all impacting the president with regard to the November election, the decision to move forward with his rallies, the confluence of events happening in this country right now? You've been looking at this?
I have. And when you hear from the campaign, their dominant strategy is turning out their base. They know that they are facing new levels of unpopularity, and there just hasn't been much emphasis on trying to win over people who perhaps weren't on the Trump train in 2016. And so the president has to get to these rallies, which is why we've seen such a push for him to do so, because his mindset regarding November is that if he is going to win again, mostly going to be because of the people who sent him to the White House in the first place.
Well, we'll watch. Let me go overseas for a moment, because in China, officials moved rapidly to seal off Beijing this week, population 22 million people, by canceling flights, closing schools amid growing fears that a second wave of COVID-19 is gathering strength and could spread to the rest of the country. Interestingly, Hayes Brown, genetic material of viruses found in patients in Beijing matched sequences found in patients in Europe. So the suggestion this week that livestock and produce could carry the virus, there was some of that, which has worrisome implications, of course, for international trade. What did you see in China this week and internationally with regard to the coronavirus?
What we're seeing is, I think the what we're seeing is a vision of what even the best countries in terms of controlling the virus still can see resurgences, that no matter how well you think you've stamped it down at this point, you can still see a comeback. You saw this in South Korea. They began to open up after managing to rapidly control the rise in numbers. And they saw a spike all of a sudden. Now, thankfully, South Korea, unlike the United States, has a better testing and tracing system. And China, for all of their, shall we say, harsher methods that they use, has been pushing much more forcefully to keep this virus in check. You see schools closed. You see the fact that they're re-raising the level of worry for people out on the streets. And it's really... makes you wonder what will happen, whether or not the U.S. will actually seem to, as it is right now, just give up on the idea of controlling the virus at all, and what the numbers will look like by the time we do hit November in terms of caseload, in terms of whether or not the virus is still on the rise, and in terms of death toll. And I just want to point out really quickly, the president earlier said that we're seeing a lot of progress in terms of things like treatment and vaccines. But Dr. Fauci himself pointed out that he would move to block any Trump administration move to get a vaccine out onto the market before it's ready, as some are beginning to worry that they will do as sort of an October surprise before the election.
Well, thank you for that. Quickly to North Korea, which blew up a joint liaison office this week, created as a sign of goodwill between North and South Korea. Lisa Desjardins, quickly, this has ended a detente on the Korean Peninsula that's lasted, well, about 2 years now.
Right, that's right. And it also shows the emergence, as we've seen before, of the sister of Kim Jong-un. Kim Yo-jong seems to be more and more important in North Korean politics. They blew up a liaison building. The North Koreans act proportionally. They are reacting, they say, to we're sending, not the government, but South Koreans activists sending balloons over the border. They reacted by blowing up a building. So it's important to watch that in addition to all of these other stories swirling at this time. I mean, it's just a time of immense pressure on the world for so many reasons, including here.
Well, today is Juneteenth, and we'd like to remember this day and talk about it for just a few moments. Back to the rally in Tulsa, the protest, that rally actually was scheduled for today, Juneteenth, the day that commemorates the end of slavery in this country. Eugene, remind us why the president decided to reschedule.
Well, the president likely rescheduled because of pressure from even critics within his own party that this came off as incredibly insensitive for him to be re-entering the rally space on this very important national holiday to many Black Americans, given his past positions on so many past comments, should I say, on so many issues related to racism and his current positions on police violence and racial discrimination in America. And he, quite frankly, continued to be insensitive, perhaps, and not aware of the significance of this day earlier this week by saying that prior to him scheduling his rally today, no one had ever heard of Juneteenth and that he made it popular, which we all know is not actually true.
He made it famous. Yes, that's what he said. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that he was signing an executive order to make Juneteenth a holiday for New York State employees, as well as his intention to introduce legislation that would make it a state holiday in the future. Here he is.
It is a day that we should all reflect upon. It's a day that's especially relevant in this moment in history. I'm going to sign an executive order today hence all my pens, recognizing Juneteenth as a holiday for state employees, and I'm going to propose legislation next year to make it an official state holiday.
In fact, this week on the U.S. Capitol grounds, portraits of former U.S. House speakers who served in the Confederacy were removed from the walls of the U.S. Capitol. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the four paintings represented violent bigotry and grotesque racism. Eugene Scott, how will this day, this Juneteenth day commemorating the end of slavery, be remembered and celebrated differently this year, do you think?
Well, one, quite frankly, there is so much more attention on it, and not just the actual holiday, but the continued legacy that the enslavement of Black people had and continues to have in our country, and connecting that to the gap between Black and white people when it comes to wealth and health disparities between Black and white Americans and policing, quite frankly. And so it's very much a relevant topic to be considering and entertaining today heading into this election. And that's why you're seeing people on Capitol Hill and across the country really engage this.
Hayes Brown, New York and Virginia moved to make Juneteenth a state holiday this week. Is there a broader need, to your mind, for a national holiday to commemorate this day?
I mean, personally, I think yes, absolutely. I think that celebrating the day that the last people in the Union learned officially that they had been, that they were free, is an important thing to commemorate, more so than possibly, say, Columbus Day in October, if people wanted to make a one-to-one swap. I will say, though, that for all of the importance of Juneteenth and all of the importance of the attention it's being given both by state governments, politicians, by businesses who are moving to give their employees the day off, even if there is no official holiday on the books, I think it's important to note that these are symbolic, but they're still just symbols. They're not actual change that is needed to move forward and obtain the goals of the protests that are happening on the streets.
Let me play this excerpt of a spoken word poetry featured on today's News O'Clock podcast, episode of Juneteenth, hosted by my guest, Hayes Brown. Mariah Parker describes decades of systemic racism and inequality.
Make it swing to the left like a conga line as we usher in the forgotten kinds, the Blacks and Latinx, the younger kids, and the Wonder Women who be running women to restructure systems like our justice system, reproductive issues getting undermined. Might have been under the Reagan administration, never undermined. A lot of relationships between the church and the state, the boss and the laborers, the cops and the neighbors, the doctors and laypersons, Blacks and the bakers, the gays and the cake bakers, us and the nation. Cauterize it, then to call it fine. It's like calling a broccoli cauliflower, like apples and oranges. Next thing you know, it's a riot outside from Newark to New Orleans.
Hayes Brown, this is from your podcast. I'll give you the last word on this. What do you want people to remember or to know about this day, Juneteenth?
I think it's really important for people to remember that this wasn't that long ago in our history. This is 155 years ago, 1865. It was when the people in Galveston, Texas, first learned that they had been freed. And I think it's important to know that there is a deep, rich past of Black history that is untapped in this country that people need to learn more about. And I think that's necessary for moving forward in the future.
Got about a minute left here. Quick round robin. Looking forward, Lisa Desjardins, what are you seeing this week upcoming? What should we have our eyes on?
Well, I think in the Congress, the debate over policing is going to be number one. And I think it is really important for us as we keep our eye on these holidays. And I have to say, as someone who loves July 4th, I'm only understanding now how incomplete that holiday is. And we've got to look at sort of systemic racism and how we talk about it. But the next tangible thing is going to be in the U.S. Congress next week with policing.
What about you, Eugene Scott? 10 seconds here.
There will be continued interest on my part in the vice presidential pick coming from Joe Biden and how this individual could help restore perhaps his standing with some of the more liberal voters on issues related to race and policing. Mm.
Hayes Brown, last 10 seconds for you. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing we're looking at the end of Pride Month. We're looking at how these protests continue to move forward or not, and how coronavirus cases rise or stay level as states begin to reopen.
Well, thank you all very much. A really informative and interesting hour. Thanks for your reporting. Hayes Brown from BuzzFeed. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Eugene Scott, political reporter from The Washington Post. Eugene, thank you.
Glad to be here.
And Lisa Desjardins, PBS NewsHour. Lisa, thanks.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.